about this incredibly beautiful fantasy world that is right next to this really abject poverty and this sort of struggling situation in the US. And to see it through a child's eyes is really unique.
After his sensational 2015 film Tangerine, director Sean Baker is back with The Florida Project, which played as part of the Director's Fortnight at this year's Cannes Film Festival. From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Also today...
Up in the sky! Look!
It's a bird!
It's a plane! It's Superman!
We'll find out how comic book illustration and the remarkable Superman cartoons by Max Fleischer influenced generations of artists. And
tudo que nós fizemos, tudo que está vendo aqui,
everything was born out of ideas I had at the start of my career. Since then, I've looked at the characters like children, and my wife is director of the studio, so she understands the philosophy as well as I do.
We'll visit Brazil's leading animation studio, the Turma de Mônica, and meet the man who started it all, Mauricio de Souza. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
In the decade of the 1930s, even the great city of Metropolis was not spared the ravages of the worldwide depression. In the times of fear and confusion, the job of informing the public was the responsibility of the Daily Planet, a great metropolitan newspaper whose reputation for clarity and truth had become a symbol of hope for the city of Metropolis.
It is by now a familiar story. The infant Superman rockets to Earth moments before the planet Krypton is destroyed. He's raised in small-town America before moving to the big city of Metropolis to work for a major newspaper, the Daily Planet. Superman's origin story has become a modern myth, embedded in the folklore of popular culture the way a fairy tale might have been passed down from generation to generation centuries ago. Superman's influence on cinema is, as the early cartoon writers might have put it, more powerful than the pounding surf. The release of the spectacular 1978 film starring Christopher Reeve proved that a superhero could be taken seriously by an adult audience. It was the second highest-grossing film of the year, behind Grease, and quickly became Warner Brothers' most successful film. But while the story of Superman's mainstream appeal owes plenty to the visionaries behind the blockbuster film, the idea of illustrations telling a story that was more than a childhood distraction began decades earlier, in the minds of writers and pioneering artists, and in the pages of comic books.
The tremendous crowds which you see gathered outside the stock exchange are due to the greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange in market prices.
October 24, 1929. The United States had just experienced its most devastating stock market crash ever. As the 1930s dawned, the nation and much of the world entered a brutal new economic reality. American industrial production plunged 47%, unemployment ballooned at over 20%, the Second World War was about to begin, many found it difficult to remain hopeful.
The Wall Street panic, in my opinion, is over. It had to come. Stock speculation had become crazy. Like an appendix operation, it's a good thing to have it over with.
Comic strips had already proved popular in the pages of newspapers. Many took the form of a simple gag-a-day structure, such as Blondie, which has been published since 1930, or, decades later, Garfield. In 1929, two characters made their newspaper debuts on both sides of the Atlantic. In the United States, space adventurer Buck Rogers leapt from the pages of a novella into his very own syndicated comic strip, while in Belgium, the adventures of Tintin debuted in the youth supplement of a conservative newspaper. At the time, comic art was still dominated by cartoonish comedy, and standalone comic books were still in their infancy. Tintin's creator, Hergé, was less interested in the gag-a-day format. His protagonist was an adventurous journalist on a fearless quest for the truth. At a time when many Europeans had good reason to fear their way of life coming to an end, Tintin's idealism and canine companion Snowy proved an effective means of escapism.
Easy, Snowy. Captain Haddock, that's him, the man from the market.
Why, that no good.
Wait! Let's see what he wants.
While the tone of the stories Tintin found himself in were a little more serious compared to his cartoonish counterparts, Hergé was creating his own style from a blend of cartoon characters set against a detailed backdrop. With his subjects outlined in a clear black line and bold colours, with little contrast, Hergé's illustrations took on a timeless aesthetic, later known as Lin Clair, that have inspired generations of artists, including British illustrator Martin Handford, the man behind the Where's Wally series. Meanwhile, however, on the other side of the Atlantic, another character was about to take the art of illustration into a whole new world, in just a single bound.
Up in the sky! Look!
It's a bird!
It's a plane! It's Superman!
Superman's first appearance in Action Comics No. 1 in June 1938 steered the American comic book in a whole new direction almost overnight. 1 year later, Batman would debut, and within just a few years, competitors were taking flight in various incarnations of the familiar caped outfit. But arguably, the artistic style of a comic book saw its most impressive leap into another medium in 1941, when Fleischer Studios produced a series of 17 hand-drawn Superman cartoons.
Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound, this amazing stranger from the planet Krypton, the Man of Steel, Superman! Empowered with X-ray vision, possessing remarkable physical strength, Superman fights a never-ending battle for...
To give Superman a lifelike movement, quite different to the famous Disney cartoons of the era, Fleischer employed a process called rotoscoping, which involved artists tracing the movement of an actual person, frame by frame, over a piece of glass. It was a time-consuming concept, especially when compared to the much easier to manage spaghetti arm technique seen in the popular Popeye cartoons. Eventually, Fleischer's artists honed their craft. Any actions that couldn't be rotoscoped, like flying, were given to trained figure illustrators. In fact, Superman's ability to fly was actually the idea of the studio. In the comics, he could only leap. It was only after the Fleischers decided that leaping looked silly, and they asked the publisher for permission to make Superman fly. While other animation studios were aiming for crazy laughs, Fleischer's creations began to look more like the sketches of Leonardo da Vinci, giving animation a new kind of integrity, just as it began to carve out its own cinematic genre.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
This broadcast is brought to you by West. Here is CBS News correspondent Mike Wallace.
Kantian is here. 2 miles south of the demilitarized zone at the narrow top of South Vietnam, 12 miles inland from the South China Sea.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour, in this office.
The death of television Superman George Reeves in 1959 had given people cause to wonder whether the character would ever survive. Popular culture underwent enormous change throughout the 1960s that, by the time the 1970s dawned, comic books, especially the square-jawed Americanism of Superman and Batman, seemed embarrassingly out of date. It was around this time that Marvel comics began to emerge, with characters such as Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four presenting heroes as flawed human beings cast aside by the status quo. Then came the massive generational shift that would alter the course of comic book and human history.
My son, it is forbidden for you to interfere in human history.
One thing I do know, son, and that is you are here for me.
For two decades, the character of Superman had been a fond memory of an old TV adventure series. Now, for the very first time, audiences saw the real flesh and blood Superman take flight on the screen.
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me! Who's got you?
And Christopher Reeve became the definitive Superman for a new generation. The Man of Steel's restored popularity led to a renewed interest in his comic book origins. Artists such as Neil Adams, Carmine Infantino, and Kurt Swan brought a revised edge to the art of illustration, eschewing the old cartoonish style in favor of modern graphic details that placed a greater emphasis on facial expressions and presented superheroes not as Saturday morning distractions, but as real, morally conflicted people. Towards the end of the 1970s, Will Eisner began to popularize the term graphic novel with his book A Contract with God. It told four disparate stories of poor Jewish people living in a rundown borough of New York. Eisner was already a pioneer of the comic book world, having created a costumed character, the Spirit, in the 1940s. He was among the first to see the serious potential of storytelling in the pages of comic books. As the pop art movement came to prominence, artists such as Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol, and Jasper Johns gave comic book art a new place on the walls of some of the world's most prestigious galleries.
You do not remember me. I am Jor-El. I'm your father.
In 2017, with big-screen superhero franchises in a constant state of regeneration, it's tempting to overlook the influential role that comic book illustrators have had on the wider world of art and illustration. But as Superman learns during his first encounter with his father in the Fortress of Solitude, it pays to remember where you came from.
Always hold in your heart the pride of your special heritage. They can be a great people, Kal-El, they wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, their capacity for good. I have sent them you. My only son.
After last year's poorly received Batman vs. Superman, Warner Brothers will be hoping for better luck when Justice League hits theatres next week. And with a poster recalling the work of artist Alex Ross, anticipation among fans is certainly high, but will anyone give the franchise another chance? That is, for now, the world's mightiest question. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Still to come, Tara Judah will give us her verdict on The Florida Project, director Sean Baker's follow-up to 2015's Tangerine, which was shot entirely on three iPhones. And up next, we'll pay a visit to Brazil's leading animation studio. But first, a word from the news desk.
Disney Marvel's Thor Ragnarok opened with $121 million in the North American box office and an incredible $431 million worldwide. The latest installment of the Thor series has been welcomed by critics as one of the best Marvel releases ever, a much-needed success for the movie industry after a disappointing October in the box office. and the clever experts at MUBI have put together a selection of Maverick director Takashi Miike's film, celebrating the fact he just launched his 100th film. Among the films on show are his Dead or Alive trilogy and Rainy Dog. MUBI is the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Sample a month for free by heading to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle.
Whether consciously or not, we often see comic books and animation as coming from only two parts of the world, Japan and the United States. But of course, there are many others contributing to the evolution of moving illustrations. Brazil's largest animation studio is the Turma de Monica. It started out as a small comic book production house founded by Mauricio de Souza, who still runs the company today at the age of 81. Since publishing his first comic in 1959, he's expanded from the printed page into cartoons and films, creating hundreds of characters, with many becoming icons of Brazilian popular culture. Some of the most famous faces are based on de Souza's own children, who have played an essential role in the studio's success, both on screen and behind the scenes. Monocle's Frederick Berners dropped by the Turma de Monica on a recent road trip to São Paulo, and he sent us this report.
Monica! Toy.
This episode of the animated series, Monica Toy, has had more than 75 million views on YouTube. It features the cult character Monica, created by Mauricio de Souza as a young artist in the 1960s, and named after his own daughter. Today, he is nearly 82 and runs a studio with 400 employees. Animated adaptations have become as popular as the original comics, with nearly 3 billion views around the world. De Souza says his family has always played a crucial role in keeping his ideas fresh.
Como o nosso público leitor primeiro é criança, eu não posso deixar de tentar me colocar no lugar delas.
As our audience is primarily children, I need to try and put myself in their place to understand what's happening with technology, habits, and everything else. One vital thing is that I have 10 children who were born over the last 50 years, so I've been talking to 10 people who speak the language of their own particular time. That's how I've stayed up to date for so long. Today, our comics speak the language of 13 to 15-year-olds, which is the language of the world, because it's still not very sophisticated, but neither is it infantile. That's my way of creating a universal understanding with everything I release.
É o meio termo que ajuda a compreensão universal dos temas, das histórias e tudo que eu estou lançando.
Calma, nofe, quanta fome, hein? Toma pedacinho. Ai!
Arriving at Mauricio de Souza Productions, I got a sense that it wasn't a normal office when I met a shaggy black dog in the lobby. He was sitting across the hall from a larger-than-life model of Bidou, de Souza's first character, a cheerful blue dog with a cheeky smile. Raised in an artistic family, de Souza was fascinated by comics at an early age. As a teenager, he drew inspiration from American comic book franchises and dreamed of launching a similar venture. So he worked as a newspaper reporter to learn about the industry before starting to sell his own tall stories to publications around Brazil. Fast forward more than 50 years, and his project has demonstrated striking resilience, both artistically and financially, in a country which has been through more than its fair share of economic challenges. Sidney Guzman, a journalist who now works as an editor at the Turma da Mônica, told me that de Souza changed the game for the Brazilian comics industry.
Ele é realmente o cara que fez a diferença no mercado.
He's the guy who transformed the market. When Mauricio was celebrating 50 years of production, the president of his first publisher said something which really makes you think. The only country on the planet in which a native author has overtaken Disney is Brazil. Mauricio started at that company with a circulation of 200,000 against millions for Disney. 10 years later, he's reversed that, and today he sells much, much more than Disney here in Brazil.
E hoje ele vende muito, muito, muito mais do que a Disney no Brasil.
Turma da Mônica sales clock in at around 2.8 million copies per month. If every magazine is read by an average of 3 to 4 people, the total audience would be over 10 million. De Souza says he is most proud of his educational impact. It's impossible to quantify how many people have learned reading and writing with the help of his stories. The character Monica has even been made an ambassador for UNICEF in Brazil. Author Henrique Rodrigues says the combination of accessibility and compelling storytelling is fundamental.
Eu posso dizer que mais pessoas, principalmente crianças, leem quadrinhos.
So many people have grown up with Turma da Mônica. The comics are relatively cheap, so they reach a huge audience. Maurício de Souza has created classic characters. People always smile when you mention their names. If you read a story from 15 or 20 years ago, it's as enjoyable as the stories he writes today. And Maurício is also a great businessman. I would like to ask him how we can get adults to love narrative writing as much as children love those comic books. It's fantastic that somebody like him exists in Brazilian culture.
Como ele consegue fazer com as nossas crianças e os nossos jovens?
De Souza's other main characters are Monica's group of friends. Cebolinha is a mischievous boy with spiky hair and a strange way of speaking. Magali is a girl with a yellow dress who takes after one of De Souza's own daughters and is hungry all the time. And Cascão is a wild child who plays with trash and is afraid of water. They all have distinct personalities which have been carefully developed for decades. De Souza talks about his real and fictional families in the same breath. It's clear that both have been equally important in the Turma da Mônica's history.
Tudo que nós fizemos, tudo que está vendo aqui.
Everything was born out of ideas I had at the start of my career. Since then, I've looked at the characters like children, and my wife is director of the studio, so she understands the philosophy as well as I do. It's a company which has a father and a mother, and my real children also work here with us. Many people don't manage to achieve that. I think it's a great secret of our success.
Eu diria, você perguntou o segredo é que a firma tem pai e mãe.
Some of those personalities will be jumping out of cartoon animation and into three dimensions very soon, as production of the Turma da Mônica's first live-action film is currently underway. De Souza says his biggest challenge over the years has been growing the business while maintaining total independence by refusing outside investment. As the studio speeds ahead with its prolific output of content for all platforms, his stream of creativity shows no sign of running dry. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Frederick Burns.
Thank you, Frederick. Now, when director Sean Baker premiered his 2015 film, Tangerine, the fact that it had been shot on just three iPhones became one of the more talked-about facets of the Sundance Film Festival. But it also happened to be a very good film. Baker is back now with The Florida Project. This time, he's ditching the iPhone in favour of 35mm film, and he swapped Sundance for the director's fortnight at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Tara Judah, tell us more.
Sean Baker's really taken a story here, and you know, it's worth saying that he came to this through his co-writer and that he was kind of sent articles and he did a bit of research first to understand a situation that he didn't know existed in America. And I think that's one of the things that this film shines a light on, is that it is a social issues movie in the one sense, because it is shining a light on something that probably a lot of people aren't aware of. And that's that the socioeconomic situation is such that people in Florida are offering in Route 92 are living in these motels kind of week to week, because they're unable to make ends meet. And so the kind of the situation of poverty there after the housing crisis and the situation in America right now. So it does have that sense to it, but it is also an incredibly fun, it's a really delightful film. And that is because it's told through the stories of the child. And Sean Baker's really done a lot of work in researching the area and using the actual landscape. So there's no kind of studio shots here. It's all really organic in the sense that it is the motels that are on Strip 92, Route 92 in America. It is called the Florida Project, which was the original name for the Disney World resort that was opened up there. So it's about this incredibly beautiful fantasy world that is right next to this really abject poverty and this struggling situation in the US. And to see it through a child's eyes is really unique. He uses not very well-known actors alongside a couple of very well-known actors. So Willem Dafoe and Caleb Landry-Jones are in this film. But there are also first-timers that you won't have seen before. And he did that with Tangerine. I think part of that is to make sure that, and that, you know, they're involved in kind of the consultation process and the writing as well. He also consulted people who live in the motels on Route 92 to make sure that it has an authenticity, but that he's giving a voice to really someone who never gets one, and that's young kids. And it is just dynamic because of that. You know, this young girl is just so loud and brash and in your face. And sometimes that's great and sometimes it's really overpowering. But what we get to see is we get to see what is life like for somebody else. What is a young child's view? And there are, you know, multiple children in the narrative in this film. And it's just played out honestly to perfection. It's such a beautiful film. It doesn't fall into the trap of becoming poverty porn at any time. It's really deftly handled so that it makes sure you get a sense of the fun and vitality that can still be had in difficult situations, but not that you're romanticizing that. And the reality is never distant. You always are aware of the cold, harsh, brutal reality of the situation in which they're living.
I think that's one of the, it touches upon one of the problems that we often see with this kind of film. Well, the films that claim to be of this sort of ilk, at least. You have a filmmaker who might have the best intentions of shining a light on people that don't often get voices in the cinema. But instead, as you put it, poverty porn, often it falls into that sort of category where you kind of feel like these characters aren't authentic and that the entire film is centered on whether they will escape their reality or not. And of course, the honest truth is that most people won't get to escape this reality because there are various different reasons. It's cyclical. It's something that it's always going to exist in some capacity. It takes a very talented and a very brave filmmaker to show that sort of truth without making the overall feeling something that ends up being quite depressing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is why this film is so successful for me. It's really brilliant, is that it is very, very careful about walking that line, makes sure that it's consulting with the community at all times, doesn't represent them in with an othering lens. And part of that as well is the choices in cinematography. So most of this film is shot on 35mm, and the very last sequence was shot guerrilla style on an iPhone without permission from, I think, Disney World. I don't want to give too much away, but it has a slightly ambiguous and interesting and imaginative ending to the film that gives a sense of hope while also really presenting still the harsh reality of the situation. And so I think that aesthetic shift is really important. I think the closeness of the camera, where he situates it, I mean, you really feel like you are with the kids. You don't feel like you're looking at them from an adult perspective, from a higher perspective, or from some kind of privileged position. You feel like you're there with them. And that is super important. I mean, I think cinematography is one of the things that can give us intimacy in a film. It's one of the devices that really makes the difference between, are we looking at and objectifying these people? Are we voyeurs in that sense? Or are we with them on the journey? Is our point of view somehow aligned with theirs? And I think it absolutely is. And that's what makes this film a true winner.
Okay, I warned you. One drip and you're out.
Oh, come on.
Out now.
It's going to melt outside.
It's melting inside too.
But Bobby.
Out.
Thank you very much.
You're not welcome.
Thanks to Tara Judah. And that's all for this week's show. Next week, do tune in. The Femme Fatale is back. And this time, she swapped bags of money and jewels for, well, Instagram.
I think Ingrid kind of became this vessel for us to pour all of our conflicting feelings about social media and Instagram into. We sort of asked ourselves, like, who's the worst person that Instagram could happen to? And I think Ingrid's kind of the answer to that question.
We'll meet Matt Spicer, the director of the superb new black comedy, Ingrid Goes West. And from the classic crime film Get Carter, starring Michael Caine, to the camp comedy of Flash Gordon, complete with a soundtrack by Queen, we'll sit down with the director, Mike Hodges, as his almost forgotten favourite, Pulp, finally gets a release on Blu-ray. Today's show was edited and mixed by Christy Evans and researched by Yolin Goffin. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.